Morning, we sang songs about being in God's presence and praising God coming into the throne. This morning, we were singing in heaven, and this evening, we were singing on earth, but still praise for the same God, for quite practically the same things, just in completely different places. We do serve such a good God and such a large, powerful God. I want to talk about the idea of God being holy. The morning songs and the evening songs, I thought, fit this so well. I'm actually borrowing or stealing, you can choose your own synonym there, a lesson that a cousin of mine preached last Sunday. There was a text thread, and an uncle of mine said that it was a really good lesson, so I listened to it. It's on the Embry Hills Church of Christ website. Just go back last week and look for David Bunting, and you'll hear a good version of this lesson. This is going to be a shortened lesson. That might change your opinion on how good the lesson is. I know a preacher whose son gave him grades on his sermons based on length, not on content. So we all grade lessons in different ways. But there were some ideas in this lesson that I thought were interesting, and that those are the key ideas I want to look at. Thinking about the idea of God being holy, the creatures before God in Revelation chapter 4 speak about God being holy, holy, holy. And those are important things to think about. And beyond saying, okay, go home and think about it, I sometimes don't know what to say to help you or even to help myself to think about that idea. So we're going to look at one story in particular that I think can help in that direction. There's a passage in Romans that I keep bringing up because it keeps popping up into my mind. In Romans 1:21, they didn't honor him or give thanks to him. And I've focused a lot of my thoughts over the past few years on the importance of gratitude. People who did not honor God as God, nor give thanks to God as God, then went on to do Romans chapter 1 and those two little, tiny little problems of not honoring and not thanking God. And so tonight we're really going to be looking at the honor aspect of it. It's good for us to slow down and try to think about those ideas and to think about who and what God is. There's a phrase that I like to repeat. It might be a little hyperbolic and too large, but I believe that the moment you've defined God, you've limited God. If you say God is, and then you finish that sentence, that's not a bad thing to do, but God's more than what your sentence just said. And the moment you remember your old thoughts about what God is, you've missed who God is. And so it's the importance of continuing to think about the largeness of God or the understanding of God or the faithfulness of God or the loving kindness of God. We need to think about the ways that God reveals himself. And so we're going to consider a story that reveals the gravity of God's holiness by looking at Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20 is a story not of people keeping God holy, but instead of refusing to keep the holiness of God or to remember the holiness of God. And the word belief or uphold is holy, or some translations have sanctify, is going to show up here. I think it's in verse 12, and I'm not really going to spend as much time with the idea of belief, but it's going to come up some. My mind was thinking on sanctifying or holifying or keeping somebody as holy and remembering God as holy. Those are the ideas that were jumping out at me. Numbers 20 in the timeline is the Israelites looked into the land, sent spies into the land, failed to take the land, and have now finished out their 30-some years of wandering in the wilderness. They had 38 years of that wandering. I don't know if they've got more than a whole year between Numbers 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 1, but they're at the end. They're basically done. They're finished with complaining about water. They're finished with complaining about food. And so they've done all the things, right? These are the good ones. And so we pick up here in chapter 20, verse 2, now there was no water for the congregation. I just think I don't understand. They've complained about water so many times, they're going to continue. I understand feeling thirsty, and I'm sure I don't know how thirsty they felt. I've never felt that thirsty in my life, but the lateness of this complaint really surprises me. Now, there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. And the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Would that we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness, that we should die here, both we and our cattle? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." Then Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. And so you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle." And Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice. The water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank and their livestock. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them." These are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with the Lord, and through them he showed himself holy. I like this picture because Moses is really going to whack that rock. Sometimes it's this gentle crack, but that's why I like this picture. We have the people complaining again. It's a very late complaint. I find that highly interesting. And we have a few of the statements there at the beginning, how it was against Moses and Aaron, and that they were quarreling with Moses. All you got to do is flip back a few pages and see what the last few chapters have been about. And you'll realize by using your chapter headings, you don't have to read all those chapters right now, that that's what the people have been doing. Not just complaining about food, but actually fighting and struggling against the authority that has been placed over them. And here they are against Moses and Aaron again. So there's a lot of problems in this complaining that really surprises me. And then there's also that idea, why are they complaining to those guys? They've had God floating above them for so long. God has been performing the miracles, both of blessing and of destruction. God is the one who has made miraculous food just show up, water just show up, and yet they still go and complain to these guys. God is in charge, but they're complaining to them. I think it does demonstrate that spiritual leadership is always complicated, that it's so easy to complain to a spiritual leader when it might be God is the one with whom we are frustrated. But it does reveal a lot about what Moses has been dealing with in these previous chapters, and maybe that's what feeds his behavior. There is this falling down before God. I see humility and a right conduct there, and God gives instructions on how to get the water out of the rock. They've got rock. What does Moses do? He loses his religion. I mean, that's one of my favorite R.E.M. songs. It's an old Southern phrase when somebody and you're looking at them and they're just behaving incorrectly, and man, he just lost his religion. And I never thought of a phrase more appropriate than when Moses was given instruction by God and does something different. And we even have that phrase in verse 9, "as commanded him." And that's the interesting phrase that shows up right before the story of Nadab and Abihu. They did as the Lord commanded, da-da-da-da-da-da, as the Lord commanded, da-da-da-da-da-da, as the Lord commanded. Then Nadab and Abihu did something that was not commanded. It's very loud in comparison to the previous chapters. If you read just the story of Nadab and Abihu, it doesn't scream at you the way it does if you've read the previous chapters of all the work that they've been putting on. As the Lord commanded, as the Lord commanded. Here, Moses does something as the Lord commanded, and then he doesn't. He doesn't do what the Lord commanded. And he has this outburst. In verse 10, "Shall we bring water for you?" And then he lifted up his hand in 11 and struck the rock. Moses doesn't seem to keep God as God, but Shall we bring this water out from you? We have this disobedient behavior, very specifically disobedient. God said one thing and he does another. And we can quabble about how big of a disobedience it is, but it's clear that when God said the one thing, he did another thing. And then God gives these reactions in verse 12, these two responses. I love these phrases. Just looking at verse 12. Because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore, and then we get the consequences. And I think did not believe in me is a really interesting phrase. And it gives us some moment here to start thinking about what does it mean to believe. This is going to add a really interesting color to the painting of the definition of belief, according to Dan Bunting, is, and I have all my ideas and all the things that I've been fitting into the concept of belief, and who could believe in God more than Moses, for goodness sake? And God charges, you did not believe in me. There is a to uphold me. You didn't believe in me to do a thing. So there is a connection there. But to tell Moses that Moses didn't believe in God is opening up a new chapter in what is belief. I think that the story is interesting for that. I think it's going to be a little bit more than God exists or, you know, even the demons believe and shudder. I think that that's an interesting idea. Even the demons believe and have a reaction to it. I mean, maybe that's the point of shuddering. I don't know. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, it talks about you must believe that God is and that God is a rewarder. He knew that God was still up there, but he didn't care about the rewards or consequences. Maybe that's the idea. I don't know. But that's an interesting thing to think about. But then there is a statement, you did not uphold me as holy, which is a nice, easy to understand phrase in the ESV, but it's a bit cumbersome and long. You did not sanctify me is a better line, even if that's an old-fashioned word that we need to define as uphold me as holy. But it's cleaner in the older translations. You didn't sanctify me in the eyes of the people. So there's tremendous consequences that are tied to the holiness of God. Moses, who seems to be his sole purpose in his life, was to get himself and the people to the Holy Land, won't. And this story hurts. This story hurts. Moses failed to rightly or righteously lift up God to his holy place. Who did Moses lift up in this story? I want to think about these consequences. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. When we interact with the story, and especially living as we are in the 21st century, okay? So this is we are a different kind of person than was alive back then. We're still metabolizing food like they did, but we see the world with different eyes. You know, we live under a democracy. We are all liberal-minded. That doesn't mean that we're liberals. We are liberal-minded. We are coming from a few centuries of that sort of premise of thinking. We are moderns, whether we want to admit it or not. We are a different thinker than what existed 400, 500 years ago. We think a very certain way, and we look at this story, and we go, come on, God. The Israelites have been complaining about water over and over, and you're not keeping them out of the promised land for that. And Moses did this one thing. Come on, God, they built a golden calf. And you didn't keep them all out of Israel for that. And Moses did this one thing. And we start trying to weigh out in the balances and these scales. This story has a very extreme reaction. And maybe you have the heart of God in you with this. And you say, nope, this is bad. This is awful. But there might be some other Bible stories that give you pause. Right? There's a story of Nadab and Abihu. Nope. I think that, but there's going to be a lot of stories that are complicated. The Israelites were told to kill all the Canaanites. That's a tough idea to understand and to swallow. That was God's judgment. And I understand from God that there was a lot of wicked people who needed to die. That's a hard thing to understand. The story of Uzzah, that's a hard one to understand. Ananias and Sapphira, and there's these moments. It's particularly the moments when we see God having a very fast to our comprehension judgment to it. And we think of normal humans who have quick judgments in a few seconds. You know, God can think a lot more in a few seconds than we were able to. And so we need to not describe him or think about him as just in human terms. But it's okay to admit that seems kind of extreme. Because I think the more we think about that, God, you're overreacting, possibly. Then that'll give us the opportunity to try to figure out, well, why did God react in such an extreme way, if I believe it's extreme? I think this story can help us with some of the other ones. What fed the punishment? There's a number of times when this story gets retold by Moses. In Numbers chapter 27, just a little bit later on, when you have seen it, when he's talking to Moses about seeing the promised land, you also shall be gathered to your people, as your brother Aaron was, because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin when the congregation quarreled, failing to uphold me as holy at the waters before their eyes. He calls, I almost called him Noah, and then I almost called him Abraham. Moses called the people rebels, and then God turns that around and says, but you are the one who actually rebelled against my word. And in the Deuteronomy sermons, chapter 1, verse 37, even with me, the Lord was angry on your account and said, you shall not go up there. And in chapter 3, but the Lord was angry with me because of you and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, enough of you from you. Do not speak to me of this matter again. Moses had been pleading with God, and God said, enough with this. Don't ask about this anymore. And there's this connection that we've seen a few times. I've been underlining it. Hopefully you've seen it, that there's this on account of you. There's something, I'm going to point at you guys as if you're the bad Israelites. You're the reason that I have this kind of consequence, or my consequence is connected to you, what I did in relation to you. Kind of gets back to a little bit of our discussion in 1 Corinthians. At the end of chapter of Deuteronomy 32, because you broke faith with me in the midst of the people of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin, and because you did not treat me as holy in the midst of the people of Israel. For you shall see the land before you, but you shall not go there into the land that I am giving to the people of Israel. And so there are two aspects of this that show up, not in every single one of these verses, but they do tie up here together. There was this failure of belief. I'm not going to look as much at the idea of belief, but there was this failure of sanctifying the sanctified God. There was a failure of holifying, upholding as holy, the one who was holy. God is holy, and what Moses did was unholied him, profaned him is the actual word. I'm making up a lot of words tonight. And he also did that before the Israelites. And God keeps bringing that up. Or God through Moses keeps bringing that up. So it wasn't just that an individual did a mistake, but there is this connection to these other people. It was a catastrophic failure to completely disobey the spoken words of God given from the mouth of God right to the man who acts as the mouth of God, but it becomes cataclysmic when the man who is the walking mouth of God does not sanctify the sanctified one before the sanctified people. I think that that's a big part here. Put some weight behind the statements from James. Not many of y'all should be teachers because, and this we see what that because, one of the things that because is connected to. Moses failed in his belief, his trust, his obedience to God. Moses failed in sanctifying a sanctified God. In Numbers chapter 16, there was a big showdown to see who is the man that God chooses to be the man who will speak. And Moses was the man. And those who were deemed not worthy were eaten by the ground. And that man smacked the rock and said, am I going to bring this water out for you? Are we going to bring this water out for you? I think it's healthy to say, God, that's an extreme reaction, because it'll give us some the impetus to try to think about why was God's reaction so extreme. Often we'll realize that the behavior that seemed minor was itself extreme. And if we don't think that Moses' behavior was extreme, we need to take the time to think about that. And I think it's going to get more extreme in your mind the more you think about it. There is a lot of weight behind these consequences. Here's another picture, photograph of Moses smacking the rock. It's more of a poking one. That's why I saved it for later. Just looking up the word believe, as it's used in Hebrew, it means to support and confirm, to be faithful, to uphold, to stand certain. So you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy. He didn't support and confirm that, both to himself and at the people. There was the statement in the lesson this morning about how, well, I've just got this question or these questions that I haven't quite figured out yet. And those can be this undermining process that destroys our foundation. All it took with the Pharisees saying stuff like, well, Jesus and his disciples, they don't seem to wash their hands like they should. And even they get a good reason why. Well, I just bring up that question, and it has this undermining effect. And we need to be believing in and confirming who and what God is. It's going to lead us to think about and understand God. Not just, I accept there is a God, but it's going to have me start to think about it and appreciate him, his power, his authority, that he is just, that he is what justice is, that he is righteousness, and that we get righteousness and understand righteousness from him. We don't know anything about love apart from the fact that God has loved us, and now we can know what love is like and what right love should be. And so there's those aspects of Moses' behavior that was not there. But then there's this uphold as holy, which is a cumbersome phrase for sanctify. And it doesn't sound like in English, but sanctify and holy have the same root in these languages, which is why I like to say holify. You know, just take that noun and make it a verb. And that's the idea that we need to think about here. To consecrate, to sanctify, to prepare, to dedicate, to be hallowed, to take them something and to set it apart. I don't like the phrase set apart. It's too casual, especially for the concept of holy is the opposite of casual. And so I keep trying to figure out ways of thinking about it. Holding God to be high. It's not set apart, set above, set on high, because all of these other things are the common things. These are the low things. Well, I don't think this is low behavior. If there is a God who is above, then absolutely everything I do is low in comparison. And so when we start to think about it in that connection, all we're able to do is going to be low or common, and so we need to be made holy by God, and we come to holify him and acknowledge him and see him as set apart and set the one who is set apart apart from us. I don't think Moses lowered God. He didn't pull God down. That's not what his actions were. He was wanting respect. Don't we all? But what does it mean to demand and deserve respect when you're standing next to God? It's kind of a dumb thing. Sure, I think Moses deserves some respect. But if we're all here and we're looking at Moses and there's God, who are we respecting? I mean, if we have, you know, $100 respect bucks, how many pennies are you going to save for Moses? God is there. Poor guy Moses was beat up and worn out. I can sympathize with his reaction and I can sympathize with his behavior. Shame on me for thinking I'd probably do the same thing. But what does it mean to demand respect when there is a God above absolutely every one of us? And so he was putting himself there. Shall we bring water out of the rock? I don't think Moses was making himself to be God, but that's what he did. I don't think Moses was telling the Israelites, I'm your God now, or treat me like your God now. That's not what Moses was doing, but it's absolutely what it was. And so that's the weight behind all this. If God is holy, 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 and he is holy, holy, holy in the Old Testament, and holy, holy, holy in the New Testament, what does that make you think about? What does holy, holy, holy mean to you and me as we sit here and think about God? These are big ideas. We need to think about what does it mean to lift something up or to sanctify something. You run around in the grass, especially when you're a kid. You run around in the grass, but then your mom and dad tells you, don't run and jump around this set of grass. Do you see those old rocks sticking out of it? This is a cemetery. This is a graveyard. It is disrespectful to hop around here and be happy. Like, you're not supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be respectful. You don't have to walk around sobbing, but you have to be respectful. And it's just grass. But you're understanding the reverence or the holiness, whether it's been religiously hallowed or not, the holiness of that. And then you go to a military cemetery. And that the reverence that is demanded is turned up even more. And that's some of the things that we can start thinking of. You don't pull out mom's china for popcorn and ice cream. You don't mow the lawn in your church shoes. Almost everybody has specific green-colored mowing the lawn shoes. It's almost like they're set apart in a different direction. And so we have these separations, and we've got to figure out how to keep God there in his right place. And I think maybe the more that we do that, he's going to get higher and higher every time. That's probably going to be the result. God is holy, and we must sanctify him. Or I'll use my little funny word that I like to think about. How are we going to do that? I know some of y'all like really practical applications. Good luck. I don't know. Sit around thinking holy thoughts. That's a practical thing. I don't know how what's going to... That can work for a lot of people. I'm reminded again, they didn't honor him or give thanks to him. I have the feeling that if you start giving thanks to God, you will, by default, be sanctifying and making God holy. Jesus opens up his prayer, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, holified, sanctified are you. Even the statement, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, is a statement of the holiness and the power of God. Just the simple statements do a lot. I think reciting them is going to be a great process on God's behalf and will be more important for him. And over time, it will affect and change us. I love the line in Psalm 29:2 in my translation, not the ESV. Give unto the Lord the glory due unto his name. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. And I think the holiness there is actually more about his own holiness, not that we are, get yourself really pretty and really holy, and that's the way you need to worship him, but to enjoy the absolute delight and beauty of the holiness that is our God, and to be reverential and thankful about that. We can think about the bad ways that we get messed up. Moses, he was overcome by his passions. That's the way I see it. He lost his temper. God bless him. Don't we all? Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of the rock? We've got to control that. Again, good luck. How about not good luck? We could go to God. God can help us with that. We're warned about the tongue, which is that thing that is the fly-off-the-handle tool and object. And we look at those passages in James, and we read about the great difficulty about the tongue, and the very process of reading of that is going to help us get a better control of that. We're thinking about it. We're careful about it. We go out and have a new day. We'll be better prepared to work that way. We need to think about those sorts of things. In Luke 22, we haven't read too many passages. Let's look at this. Luke 22. In Luke 22, verse 7, we see that it's the day of unleavened bread, and so they're getting ready for the Passover. That's a great paragraph, a great story to read. Verse 14, the institution of the Lord's Supper. I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. What a beautiful, touching, moving passage. What a great story to read in the Bible. Verse 22, a dispute arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. All right. Come on, guys. How many hours until Jesus is dead? I mean, I can understand you having this silly conversation a few chapters ago. What are you doing here in chapter 24? Two, sorry. They're disputing about who is the greatest when they are walking next to the greatest one who's ever lived. And he's so great, why are you disputing among yourselves? If you catch a bunch of buntings arguing about who's the tallest and they're at a Smelser reunion, what a stupid conversation. I mean, it's not worth finding out who is the tallest of the small, because the great one is there. But that's when we lose ourselves to our passions, lose control of ourselves. We need to master these things, and we need to get them under our control. Our pride and our demands end up profaning God. I think that's what they do. And so we need to not let these things get common. If you look up the word holy in the Old Testament, the noun, not the verb, sanctify, you know, to make holy or to uphold as holy, but the thing that is holy, or I guess that might be an adjective, that's the holy thing or the holy one. The holy hill is the phrase that kept showing up over and over and over again. That really surprised me. That special place, that set apart place of God. And I thought that that was interesting. My preoccupation with myself is going to destroy God's holiness and this holy place that we have set apart to worship in. My preoccupation with my own things is going to dislodge God from his holy hill. And my things are going to be the things on that holy hill. I need to make sure that nothing gets there. It's very similar to what is an idol, anything that we put up in the place of God. That's a description or a definition that people have about idols. And it's this change of the holiness or change of, in our own mind possibly, what is the great and important things. And when Moses made a mistake in holiness, and that before the people, who were the holy ones of God, and he the holy of the holy before the holy one. He was the voice of God. The repercussions of that mistake were tremendous. I don't know. There's a decent chance that Moses' disobedience and profaning of God would have been bad enough if no one was watching. I don't want to say it's just because of them, but that was brought up a lot in those descriptions. And so I want to include that. We got to be careful about who we are and what we do, and we got to remember who and what God is. We're going to close by reading Psalm, Revelation chapter 4. We looked a little bit at Revelation chapter 4, or talked about Revelation chapter 4 this morning. Revelation chapter 4, and we'll start starting in verse 6. Halfway through verse 6, the ESV has a paragraph break right in the middle of verse 6 about those who are around the throne. So we'll read this to set up the way people speak about God. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the fourth living creature like an eagle in flight. And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and within, and day and night they never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who is seated on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before him, saying, "Worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." That's just summing up what we sang about this morning and what we sang about tonight. And this broken earth demonstrates the holiness of God and is part of the holy creation of God. And we live in a redeemed time. And it is time for us then to sanctify the one who already is sanctified, but to sanctify him in our hearts, set him apart in such a way that we will keep him where he ought to be and not substitute anything there in that place. If you need help with this, if you need encouragement, if you need prayers for sin, why don't you let us know by coming forward as we stand and sing.